free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, where you'll see a past lineup of speakers and topics. You can download our past shows there. Also, you can get a phone number if you're listening live to call in with any questions you may have. Today, October 6, 2008, our guest is Ella Weinstein. She is the CEO of Principal Power, Inc. They specialize in renewable energies of a variety, off wind or offshore wind, wave, and tidal. They're actually looking at integrating all three of those in a platform. We'll be talking about that primarily today. They also are involved in some solar. We'll touch on that briefly. So I should also mention that another person there at Principal Power, Inc. is John Bonanno, who is a member of our New Energy Congress. He's been with us for about a couple of years, and been great to have him involved there. He's a great specialist in various renewables. Ella Weinstein comes with 30 years of industry experience. She's been involved in renewables for quite some time, quite an impressive bio you can find on the website, things she's been involved with. Ella, thanks for joining us. You have joined us at with late notice. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, tell us, this offshore platform that you're talking about, I was looking at your site, it's a floating platform.
That is correct. The platform, well, we call it foundation, actually, is called the Wind Float. The concept of the Wind Float was developed by the company called Marine Innovation and Technology by two people that worked in offshore oil industry and decided that there is a lot of need in the renewable energy and felt that they can adapt what the offshore oil industry has used for many, many years to the use with renewable energy and in particular with offshore wind turbines. Today, most of the offshore wind installations have happened in Europe. U.S. Does not have any installations. And the reason for that has been twofold so far. One, the location of the wind turbines, you have to put them in the fairly shallow waters, and thus it creates what we call the NIMBY effect, which people basically say they do not want to see anything in their backyard, which is what the NIMBY stands for. Second reason is that we in U.S. do not yet have rules on how to permit installations of offshore wind. Now, Minerals Management Services, which is the organization, the federal agency, which is going to be permitting offshore wind, is working on the rules, and those rules are supposed to be available early next year. So hopefully we will see a number of offshore wind developments happening in the United States. Most of them are going to be happening on the East Coast, and all of them will be in the shallow water, meaning that installation is going to have a foundation driven into the ocean floor, and that foundation will hold the mast and subsequently the wind turbine. Installing things in the shallow water is the preferred method that has been available today. But it also provides you limitations. There are certain locations around the United States where shallow water wind installations are just not available. For example, if you look at the west coast of U.S., majority of locations are going to be in deeper water. Deeper water defined as greater than or deeper than 150 feet of water. The fixed installations, which are called monopile installations, are not practical to be installed in those depths, yet most of the West Coast is going to experience that type of depth. So the wind float provides you with an ability to circumvent those technological and physical limitations and be able to capture a much better, more consistent, and stronger offshore wind resource available in the deeper offshore. The wind float is what's called semi-submersible floating foundation, meaning that part of it is submersed under the water, and it does float. It is moored to the ocean floor, and it will house 1 5 to 10 megawatt turbine on it.
Did you say 1 to 5 or just 5?
It could be a 5 megawatt turbine, or it could be a 10 megawatt turbine. One or the other.
Okay. Now, you say this is taken from the oil industry. They have those offshore rigs that are floating. They're taking that technology and now applying it to renewables so that you can then affix a wind turbine to the top of one of these floating platforms. I notice on your site you talk about an elegant method of being able to reduce the pitching and the yawing of such a platform.
Right. The oil industry has been used for years, the semi-submersible principle of the platform design. Marine Innovation and Technology started their work in designing what they call the mini float, which would be a small oil platform suitable for marginal fields. As a part of that work, they patented heave plates that reduce the ability of the platform to lean over one way or another. These same plates then migrated to the design of the wind float, and that's what allows the wind float to be very stable. The wind turbines themselves can withstand the up and down motion that will be resulting from a floating structure, but they cannot really withstand very well the pitch and the yaw and also the horizontal accelerations, gyroscopic effects that are going to result from the motion of the floating body. So the heave plates that are installed on the wind float allow the pitch angles to be greatly reduced to less than 3 degrees in normal operating conditions and less than 7 degrees in storm conditions. And that subsequently allows the use of the offshore wind turbines that previously were designed for the monopole installations. Granted that certain amount of modifications that will have to be done to the turbines, but in our discussions with turbine fabricators, they felt that those modifications, though required, are not showstoppers and can be accommodated.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the wind is hitting the turbine, making it top-heavy, so to speak, where it's going to want to make it twist over or bend over? What's to keep the platform from bending like that? I can see how it might resist some momentary transient types of pressures to pitch, but the strong wind pushing on the top of the turbine, there's a lot of torque to make the turbine tip over. How are you keeping that from happening?
If you look at our website, you will notice the design of the wind float is a triangular shape.
Mm-hmm.
The turbine is sitting on one of the legs of the wind float. The other two legs, you can think of them as counterbalancing legs. They, two-thirds of the, well, actually about half of each of the leg of three legs is filled with water for ballasting purposes. And the ballast automatically adjusts between the three legs to counterbalance the potential torque and the moment that will be created by sustained winds. So it's a combination of heave plates and the active ballast that keeps the foundation very stable.
So there's going to be an active pumping mechanism that as you have wind coming in one direction or another will adjust the water filled in the three legs so that the counterbalance is keeping the tower upright.
That is correct.
I would imagine for lower winds you get quite a bit of shifting in wind direction, but when you get higher winds they typically are a little more in one direction.
Yes, that is correct. And when we design the wind flow, because it will be adapted to any specific site, we're looking at the prevailing wind direction so that the design can be adapted for that particular site conditions. We're looking at winds, we're looking at waves, we're looking at tides and currents. All that is taken in consideration during the design process. So the heave plates will prevent you from the surge that can occur very quickly, but then over time the ballast and the heave plates will stabilize the platform and it will provide very low pitch and yaw angles.
Now, I know with wind you get some pretty good gusts, you know, sudden gusts of wind. You're saying that these surge plates would withstand that, and then when you have sustained wind in one direction, that is then going to be taken care of by the ballast adjustment?
That's correct. The heave plates are going to prevent the turbine from tipping over in the gust, and as the winds become more sustainable, because the gust normally lasts just a few seconds, then the ballast adjusts itself automatically to sustain and withstand the continuous blowing.
And if I understand correctly, you've got this moored via cables to the ocean floor. Is that going to keep it from twisting or yawing in the water?
The cables will prevent, or the mooring chains per se, they will prevent some yawing, but not... not necessarily significant, and really yaw is something that the turbines are used to seeing, so we're not really worried about the yaw as much as the pitch. And and so, again, from the numbers that we presented to the turbine manufacturers, they felt that the numbers are quite acceptable.
Now, in the case of storm surge, for example, in the Gulf Coast, where you've got the water elevating some 20, 25 feet with the wind being blowing the water so that it's much deeper than it normally is.
The mooring structure is designed to allow certain amount of fluctuation in those areas where you have significant variation in water levels due to tides or due to storm effects or due to whatever other reason. You will deploy a mooring line that will consist of chains on top, chains on the bottom, and polyester rope in the middle. And the polyester rope allows you additional slack to allow the platform to move up and down. Also, the overall mooring design gives certain amount of slack that, again, is designed to withstand significant storms in that particular location.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would imagine if there's a storm coming, you're going to try and shut things down rather than have the turbine spinning and burning up your generator.
That is correct. The turbines are parked for certain wind speeds, especially the wind speeds above, the rated operating range. And as a result of that, your storm conditions and forces that both the turbine and the wind flow will experience during the storm conditions, are adjusted. But that's all a part of the design envelope that is used while the wind float is designed and interfaced with the turbine.
I understand that one of the primary advantages of offshore wind is that you get much more steady and sustained higher wind speeds than you do onshore or immediately offshore. The further you go out, the better the winds are and the more stable. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. It is interesting to see the wind profile that you would experience onshore versus the wind profile that you will experience offshore. There is an interesting study that was done by University of Delaware. Professor Willett Kempton wrote a paper on the wind profiles that could be seen offshore in the state of Delaware. And he has one chart where he compares the wind profile onshore, shallow water, and then deep water. And it's amazing how the deep water wind almost comes to a steady, what I would call a baseline or baseload energy generation potential compared to onshore wind and shallow water wind. If anybody has ever been on a boat, you take the boat just a few miles out and you will feel a very consistent wind blowing. Reason is that the winds come from the west and they travel to the east. That's normally the nature of the jet streams, especially in the areas that we're looking at. And as a result of that, of no obstruction in the ocean, you don't have land mass that acts as a heat sink, you don't have mountain ranges, you don't have any obstructions, winds are able to blow over very long distances without much of anything, and they only increase in speeds. It's when the winds kind of hit the land that you're going to get different inversions and thermals and other elements that are going to change your wind speeds, reduce them, and create the profiles that are not consistent. Because of that, we expect the capacity factors and potential energy generation in deep water offshore to be a lot greater than we ever see in onshore. And the deeper we can go, the better the wind resource gets.
Now, on the one hand, you're getting a better wind resource but on the downside, those wind turbines can only handle so much wind speed. What's the give and take on that?
Well, the offshore wind turbines, which are really the turbines that we're looking at, we're not really looking at the wind turbines that have been traditionally designed for the onshore use. They are already designed to capture this greater wind resource that's available in the offshore. So when you look at the turbine rating that have been designed for the offshore operation, you will notice that their operating range is in the much greater speed range or wind velocity range than the ones that are designed for onshore operations.
Mm-hmm. Would you consider some of the vertical access wind turbines where you don't have as much of an issue and they can handle much higher speeds? PMA wind, for example, up in Wyoming, they've got a great design of a vertical axis turbine that could be very robust. Have you looked at some of that?
We have started looking at the turbines. We started with traditional turbines that have been designed and are being designed for offshore use. We will be looking at other turbines, including the vertical turbines. The question is going to become economics and power production. That said, because the wind float has basically three legs, and if, let's say, the vertical type turbine is suited for installation on all three legs, then potentially we can get to similar or higher energy production. But all our calculations are really driven by economics.
I would imagine that you don't have as much of the elevation issue in deep water as you do on shore, where you get much better winds higher up than you do closer to the ground.
That is correct, but you also have to consider that the blades of the 5-megawatt turbine, you're going to be with a blade with a rotor diameter of 100 meters. So you immediately picking up much higher altitudes than you would with the onshore wind turbines, because your blade diameters and blade lengths are a lot bigger.
What about the transmission when you've got cables from their platform to shore? How much of an issue is that?
It's not so far an issue. So far, an issue in terms of installation. The submarine cables is known technology, has been deployed in many locations. We have islands that are connected to mainland through submarine cables. It is really just the cost that is taken into account. But that said, offshore and especially deep ocean offshore wind installations are suitable for locating close to the population centers where your onshore wind may not be available or may be difficult to permit or just not have enough land to be able to afford to install it. So I think each population center will be looking at what renewable energy resources are there, and we certainly would like to offer the deep ocean offshore wind if that is something that the population center would require and it would make sense to do. If you take coastal states, you would find out that 80% of the population of that state actually lives on shore. So what we can offer with offshore wind, offshore wave, and potentially tidal, depending on the site conditions, an ability to bring a significant amount of very consistent energy from the offshore environment.
Now, I understand that with the offshore wind, you've got, just like onshore, when there's still going to be some transient elements where you don't, it's not a constant power generation all the time. It may be more constant than onshore, but there still is some transient nature to it. Have you considered the option of going to a secondary power source carrier such as hydrogen, electrolyzing hydrogen from the electricity and then shipping the hydrogen to shore where it can then be deployed in a hydrogen economy type of scenario?
Absolutely. And in my own opinion, since I've been in the offshore industry since 2001, that is really the future of the offshore energy generation. If you think about it, the ocean brings literally an unlimited source of energy, but most of that energy is going to be in the deeper ocean where connection to the grid will not be practical at all. You go 10 miles offshore, 20 miles offshore, and though, yes, you can put the cables through, that's not the technological limitation, you may choose not to because of the financial constraints and the cost of the cables. And that is where the stored form of energy, as I used to call it, becomes very important. So in the future, I believe we will see what I would call offshore hydrogen factories, offshore fresh water factories, where the energy derived from the ocean by various means is now transformed into a stored form that can be brought to back to shore to the population centers and deployed in distributed generation rather than building more transmission lines and underwater cables.
Okay. I need to pause for a second. I need to see my daughter off the school bus. I'll be right back. Maybe while I'm doing that, you can talk briefly about the this whole scenario of the other or secondary energy methods. I'll be right back with you.
I'm not sure what the secondary energy methods are.
Okay, I'm back. Thanks for waiting.
I'm not sure what you meant by secondary energy methods.
I was talking about hydrogen, for example.
Oh, okay.
rather than going straight to electricity, you go to another storage mechanism.
Right.
My wife is usually home to see my daughter off the bus, and she didn't make it home in time today, so I had to do that. I apologize. Now, let's talk for a minute about these other modalities that you're anticipating attaching to this floating system. And also, just for sake of context, I think the audience would appreciate knowing that before you were involved in Principal Power, Inc., you were the CEO and president of Aqua Energy, which the primary product there was the Aqua Boy, this floating wave energy harnessing mechanism, which I believe is actually listed in our top 100, in the New Energy Congress top 100 energy technologies. The idea that you have the waves going up and down, and why not put in that some kind of electromagnetic system so that as it's going up and down, a magnet going through coils generates electricity. You sold that technology to Finnevera Renewables, or Finnevera bought the company. And are you going to, would you be deploying that technology, or would it be a different kind on your platform?
Well, as you stated, my first company with the Aqua Buoy was a little bit different principle than I think what you described. It was a hydraulic system using water as a hydraulic fluid, and the water would be converted into pressurized water flow equal to 200 feet of water drop as you would have in a hydropower system. That company and that technology is now being deployed and is continues to be developed by Finnevera Renewables, a Vancouver company. We do not know which technology we're going to use in the wind float, but the wind float is a structure that would be already sitting in the ocean. And if it's already sitting in the ocean, our objective is to increase the amount of energy we can generate. And we will be studying over the next few years what methods may suit themselves better to use for the power conversion or so-called power takeoff mechanism to harvest additional energy and thus increase the total amount of energy that we can produce from the wind float. Again, once we start producing lots of energy, and we're talking, you know, a couple hundred megawatts of power, we will probably have to go to something of a stored form. And having a wind float as a structure actually allows you to build a deck, if necessary, to put additional equipment if that's what we want to do. So there is a lot of derivatives of the wind float product that can happen in the future, but you have to start somewhere. And our starting point is installation of one turbine on each wind float, connecting to the grid and delivering energy, in addition to creating economic opportunities for the community where that installation will take place.
Now, you also mentioned tidal harnessing. And I would imagine that most of the tidal energy is going to be closer to the shore. Maybe I don't understand tides correctly, as you have water flowing up and then down with the, as the earth turns around next to the moon, the gravitational force of the moon pulls the water against the landmass, creating tides back and forth each day. And where I would think that that effect would not be so pronounced or harnessable outside or in deeper water, and that the more indicated technology would be ocean currents to situate your platform where you have some currents flowing in the water.
That is correct. The tides may or may not be suitable for what we're doing. It kind of depends on where the installation is and what's available, what other forms of ocean energy would be available. That said, that is not necessarily something we're doing right now. Like I said, it's in the future. And it all depends on on locations. But we certainly will be looking at utilization of other conversion principles once we have the structure out in the ocean.
Let's talk for a second about some of the specs of these towers that you're envisioning, the weight, the size, how you would get them out there, things like that.
How are we going to get them out there? Is that what you ask?
Yeah, the wind float.
Right. Well, the wind float and one of the major advantages of the wind float compared to other floating foundation concepts that are available, and there's about three or four concepts that are being developed, and all of them are in Europe, is that the structure is being assembled in the port. So your installation of the turbine and the whole wind float will get assembled in port, and then once the turbine is installed, it will get towed to the installation site. Thus, you eliminate some of the very technologically difficult operations that today have to be performed even for the shallow water monopile structures, because boats that are used to install turbines on top of the foundation are not supposed to operate in seas that are higher than 2 feet on the west coast of the United States. I don't believe you'll be able to find the time when the seas are going to be less than 2 feet. So the weather windows become extremely limited, and the boats are very expensive, so your economics are driven by weather when you're trying to install devices. By being able to do installation in port and use just a, you know, ordinary tugboat to take the unit to its location, we reduce significantly the cost of installation, but more importantly, we're opening up the period of time when the installation can take place.
I'm curious, what is the what are the materials you're using for flotation?
For flotation, well, the flotation, you mean the float itself? The float itself will float because it's a buoyant device.
I'm just curious what kind of materials are used in the float.
Well, if you're asking what the float is made out of, it's made out of steel. It's constructed using steel.
Yeah, of course.
In the future, we may be looking at using some other materials, but for today, we are still using steel.
And we don't think if steel is floating in the water, how does it float?
The ships are made out of steel and they do float. It's the design of the buoyant devices that allows device to float. It's the displacement of the water that takes place once you put a body into the water and the way the water supports it. So the principles of creating buoyant devices are no different than design ships.
Okay. So they're basically a displacement mechanism with the steel serving as the barrier between the water and the air inside.
Yes, you can look at it that way.
Mm-hmm. From a vulnerability point of view, we live in a day of terrorism and enemies. And one of the things that an enemy can do is try and take out the combatant's electrical generation systems. And I was talking to a person who was with Homeland Security about 6 years ago, and he said that one well-placed bullet could take out the entire Western grid, not for a day, but for several months, because of the ripple and other kinds of effects that it could produce. Given that kind of mentality that we live in, where there are antagonistic forces out there, how impervious would these towers be, and how would security be an issue, or are they sturdy enough that really wouldn't be a problem?
Well, the device is certainly sturdy. They're definitely not flimsy. I don't think I can speak on what terrorists may or may not do. I think it's important also to involve the local community that are people out there in the ocean all the time, and especially the fishermen community, because if it is something that they can be benefiting from in a way, they will be watching out for it. But theoretically, if somebody wants to do some damage to something, they can certainly accomplish that. We've seen, unfortunately, with a lot more secure, bigger structures, things happen if somebody really wants to do something bad. But how do you prevent any power plant, for that matter? You know, somebody wants to drop a bomb, they can do that. So I'm not sure that really there is a so-called bulletproof solution to any power generation we have in the country, because if somebody wants to do something bad, yeah, theoretically they can.
Well, and of course, that's the advantage of having a modular system. If one goes down, you have a number of others that keep going.
That is correct, and they all can operate independently.
And speaking of modular, I would imagine that you would have these arranged in a farm where
correct.
You have a number of them together?
That is correct. So imagine if you want to have a 200-megawatt farm and you have 5-megawatt units, you will string them in a certain field, which we would call a farm, and that's how you're going to generate your 200 megawatts by having about 40 units sitting out in the ocean.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the profile of wind speeds picking up and dropping off, how I know with tidal energy, just by going down the shore a little ways, while one may be waning, another may be picking up, so that you can actually have continuous power in a grid of tidal turbines along a shore. I would imagine that wind systems are not quite the same, where they're much more generalized. You'd have to have things 200 miles apart in order to have that kind of consistency. But I'm just curious if you've run the numbers or if that would be part of your strategy in terms of providing baseload power.
Well, since we are dealing with an intermittent resource, we cannot provide baseload power. That's just not possible when you're dealing with nature. But again, as you look at the profiles available in the offshore wind, taking them from, midnight to midnight, you will see that the profile is a lot more consistent than you would ever see on land. But you're not going to be able to space them or strategically put them where the wind may blow this hour and may blow in the other place in another hour, because, again, the profiles that we see from just about any given site, they just give you a very consistent wind speeds.
Would it make sense in a scenario like this where you don't have a constant enough environmental source to provide baseload power, that at your onshore facility where the lines are coming ashore, you could be generating some hydrogen that you could then use as the wind tapers off to provide electricity during that time? Is there enough consistency in the wind with offshore wind that you could do that, or does it die off for a week at a time, for example? I'm not familiar with what the typical profile is of offshore wind, but would that kind of a scenario be plausible, so that even though the wind might not alone wouldn't be able to provide baseload power, a system that included some hydrogen storage tanks could?
Yes, the answer is yes. It certainly can be a such scenario, and that is something that we certainly will be looking as we start developing things in the future. Energy storage is an issue that is out there for any wind generation or any intermittent power generation. And, yes, you're absolutely correct that in the at the times of peak demands, we will certainly be supplying all the energy we're generating. In the times of lower demands, theoretically, we can take excess energy and use it for generating stored energy. These are all the things that we will be looking in the future as we start installing larger and larger systems. But again, I will take it back to where we are today. We don't have one installation yet in the United States, and we would like to see some shallow water wind installations on the East Coast and hopefully deep water wind installations on the West Coast.
Let's talk for a minute about where you're at in the process of rolling this out. You've got the licensing rights to this technology that has been developed by some individuals in the oil industry for renewable application, and you're looking for technologies to pair into this to put on this platform along with the wind. When do you think you'll see your first system deployed, and will you need to go through a testing phase, or are the components individually tested well enough that you wouldn't have to go through a testing phase?
I believe the components have been tested well enough in various applications in offshore oil industry and in the shallow water wind industry that we do not necessarily have to go through a lengthy development program. Also, examples from the offshore oil industry demonstrate that if you design your numerical models correctly and validated them sufficiently in various regimes in the wave tank, then you can go from a small-scale model to a full-size installations directly, bypassing, again, lengthy and expensive smaller devices. So, yes, our intent is to go through the development phase, which is where we are right now, and probably in about a year be ready to start developing a project. Because we are doing things in parallel and because we are interested to install the devices and generate electricity as soon as possible, we have initiated discussions with a number of utilities in the United States and in Europe to do incremental or what I call phased approach to commercial scale plant development. We start with the installation of a single device, though the cabling would be sized for the full-size, commercial-size installation. The permitting will be done for the full plant. But we will gradually build out as we demonstrate performance and operation in order for us to attract financing from the banks. We have to demonstrate performance not just through the numerical models, but in physical energy delivery.
Okay. And in that scenario, I would envision, you talked about a speeded up development phase. Just looking at it from an engineering point of view, I would think that the weak link, so to speak, is the pitching, even though you've got the dampers on there, that pitching is going to be introducing some pretty good stress to the traditional tower, a wind turbine, and that's going to need to be shown to not be an issue via a full-scale model.
Right, and that's why we would be installing first a single unit to demonstrate its operation, to demonstrate the amount of energy we can produce. That part of the project, which will be financed through the equity participants in the project, would allow us to then turn around and go for commercial lending, because no longer do we project what may or may not be, but we can demonstrate performance of the unit and energy generation from both structural integrity and energy consistency. And also, with having environmental permits in hand, would allow us to secure adequate commercial lending, which is what's required for plant expansion.
I do note on your website under press releases that on the 14th of May you announced closing 2.3 seed funding convertible note round. What was that about?
That was the initial funding that we raised for the company when we started the company. Subsequent to closing of the round, we signed the exclusive worldwide agreement with Marine Innovation and Technology for the wind float. And subsequent to that, we announced last week that we signed memorandum of agreement with Tillamook Intergovernment Entity for the development of 150-megawatt deep ocean offshore wind farm off the coast of Tillamook.
Where's that at?
Oregon.
Okay.
Kind of northern part of Oregon.
So you've got a customer and you've got the technology. Now it's just a matter of building?
Yep. And securing financing.
Mm-hmm. How much financing do you have yet to secure?
We are right now raising $20 million for continuous technology advancement and project development. Each project, as I described, the initial phase of the project would require equity participation. And part of our business model is to own those plants. So part of the money would be going for those equity components of future plants. Part of the money will go to continuous development of the technology to the point where the first installations can be made. And we continue developing projects in the U.S. and Europe.
Maybe now would be a good time to also address the fact that your company is also involved in the solar sector. The Mylar design, where you basically have an inflatable concentrated solar system, that maybe you can talk about that for a minute.
Yes, John Bonanno, whom you mentioned before, helped to start the company called Cool Earth Solar, where the person invented this inflatable Mylar balloon type solar concentrator. And the principle for the Cool Earth Solar design is to reduce the capital cost such that you can use components and materials that are very cheap. Because if you look at today's concentrated solar, they are all based on panels, and there is only so much cost that you can take out of a silicon panel. In addition to that, you require quite a substantial modification of land, where you have to provide a fairly flat surface in order for those panels to be installed. With cool-off solar Mylar balloons, you don't need to really alter the earth. You can use the earth as it is. And you install the Mylar balloons on poles that are not very high off the ground so that they can be serviced with people without any additional equipment. And all that leads to the installed capital cost and installed operating cost to be as low as possible. The company right now is installing its second demonstration device, and they were actually supposed to install it as we speak. Once that is done and they're going to move into the production phase of the device development and production, then we would be working with them in developing projects using cool earth solar concentrated devices.
On your solar energy page, it says these will be located in Spain, Portugal, Italy, and Mexico.
That is correct.
And so you have, are these customer contracts already in place?
We have not the customer contracts, because in Spain, for example, it's a feed-in tariff, and utilities are obligated to buy solar energy and renewable energy for that matter. So in those locations that you mentioned, which is Spain, Portugal, Mexico, what we need to have is land access, and that's the work that we're doing right now, acquiring land sites that can be suited for future solar installations.
Okay. sounds like you have quite an ambitious undertaking with these two disparate industries. I'm curious what kind of personnel you have involved in your company in terms of numbers and whatnot.
Well, we are very ambitious people. We have about six people right now in the company. The company will grow fairly rapidly as we start moving towards construction. That said, we will be relying significantly on subcontractors, such that through the development process of plants, we're also establishing relationships with fabricators. For example, for the offshore wind in Oregon, we already established a relationship with Oregon Iron Works that will be the fabricator of the wind float. Also, you need to establish relationship with the installers. And all those people come together as a team such that we don't really have to grow the number of people in the company to very large numbers, but we do work very closely with select suppliers.
Now, I notice also on your homepage you have some wording about, even more general than that, about identifying and financing deserving renewable energy projects or something to that effect?
When we started the company, we decided, both myself and John, that what our mission and what our interests, both of our interests, were in establishing renewable generation as much as possible. Because today, people financed and have put a lot of money into VC-backed technology development, but some of those technologies have not crossed the valley of death and they haven't made it into the mainstream. We wanted to pull those technologies into the mainstream. But you cannot do everything at once. That would be somewhat impossible. So we concentrated on two areas. One is the offshore wind with a wind float, then second is concentrated solar with a cooler of solar. So the way I would put it is we are concentrated and committed to specific directions, but we're always looking around to see what else will come out and would be interested, but we're not going to be really doing everything at once, because doing everything at once may not lead to the successful results.
Right. I'm noticing on your homepage, and by the way, let's give out the name of your website if you want to give that.
The website name is www.principle, spelled with a L-E, powerinc.com. So it's principlepowerinc.com.
Okay, and on the home page there, I'm seeing a picture of what looks like a solar trough. Is that just for the sake of, you know, showing something solar, or is that a specific technology you're looking into?
No, we're not really looking at anything today more than what we discussed, which is the wind float and the cooler solar concentrated solar device. That said, like I said, once we successfully move these two devices into commercial environment, we may very well look at something else, but for today, those are the two areas where we put our focus and concentration and money.
Very good. Well, we have come to the end of our segment. I appreciate you coming on our show and talking about your wind float technology and a little bit about the solar. We certainly wish you the best as you roll these things out. Again, we've been talking to Ala Weinstein. Is that how you pronounce your name?
That's close enough.
Okay. Over with Principle Power Incorporated. Their website is Principle, spelled P-L-E at the end, principlepowerinc.com, and we'll be posting a feature page about them also at pezwiki.com. You can look up. That'll be showing up here in the next few days. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.